Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Monday, May 20th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply. Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing. And you can find all the great Ware products here. Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com. Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com. It's easy and rewarding to keep backyard chickens, and My Pet Chicken can supply everything you need to get started, including baby chicks, chicken coops, accessories, books, and free how-to information, plus fun gifts and rooster decor. At My Pet Chicken, you can buy as few as 3 baby chicks.
They also sell fertile hatching eggs. Visit them online at mypetchicken.com. That's mypetchicken.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We have the Chicken Doctor that's going to be on. It is Monday, and every Monday we are honored to have Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, here. Today, a couple of things we're going to cover. He is going to cover heat-related illnesses in chickens, and then it shouldn't take too long for him to cover that, we hope, because then we've got several questions posted for Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor, that we asked for our fans to post on Facebook yesterday. So we probably have about a dozen questions we need to get through. We may even start that first and then wrap up with heat-related illnesses. So we'll probably go with that route to make sure we get all the answers, questions answered for the folks that posted them yesterday that will either listen live today or the thousands that will listen to the archive later in the week. So we'll be doing that today. Tomorrow, there will be no radio show, but we will return on Wednesday with another episode all about essential oils. We had a young lady come on, I guess it was last week, the week before, and got started talking about some essential oils and gave us kind of a good overview. But she'll be coming back on Wednesday and finishing that up, or continuing that, I guess I should say. And that'll be Wednesday. Okay, Jen was saying, no, not Wednesday. I said, yeah, we switched days. So we're not doing tomorrow. We're doing Wednesday. Okay, well, anyway, we'll deal with it. So anyway, so no worries. So let's see what we got here. And then Thursday, we've got Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, that's going to be joining us this Thursday. And then there will be no show on Friday as we go into the holiday weekend. Of course, no show on Monday because it is Memorial Day. And, well, we were going to actually not have a show Wednesday. But then, because we've got a lot of running around to do, I want to go see my buddy Phil, who's got stage 4 cancer, while we're up in Atlanta for Caleb's birthday this week. She's got a retirement party to go to. We're going to try to squeeze all that into one day, and then we were going to do that Wednesday. But then Prepper Penny couldn't come on Tuesday, so I said, well, we'll just go up today. We'll do all our running around tomorrow, and then Wednesday we'll have Tracy come on and talk about essential oils. And yes, USMC Vet, who is in the chat room off and on for since I started the show, one of my best friends. You know, you have several best friends, and I've got a handful, and he is one of my best friends. He was a neighbor up in Johns Creek when we lived up there for about 8 years, and just one of my good best friends in life. A lot of the great same values, same ideals, and things like that. But he's a really great man. And I will give you an update of what I know about that right now. He went to the oncologist last week. He went to the gastrointestinal doctor, and they did the scope and PET scans and CT scan, all of that kind of stuff. And the doc basically kind of told him he had cancer, stage 4, had spread from his stomach into his liver and into the lymph nodes. And he went to the oncologist a week later, and she says that she believes it's gotten into the bone. And so, but at this point, she didn't offer any plan of action. So she's going to, he's going back to the gastro doctor to do some surgery, because right now the tumor is at the opening where all the food that's digested in the stomach goes into the small intestines. And it's closed off, so he can't get any nutrition, which is a big part of battling cancer. So he's got a meeting tomorrow with the gastroenterologist, and he's going to schedule surgery to basically bypass where the tumor is at the exit of his stomach. so he can get back on a normal diet. Eat steak, eat potatoes, eat food, eat, you know, fruits and vegetables and get some nutrition. Take medicine, oral pills, things like that, which he can't do now other than just maybe a milkshake or some liquid diet. He's got a feeding tube in right now. Up until the surgery, so we can get some nutrition that way, and then they hopefully in this week or next week they'll do the surgery, so we can start getting some nutrition. Then I'm guessing once that's done, he's not having any pain right now whatsoever. He says, I guess he'll go back to the oncologist, and they will maybe do a plan of action or suggest a plan of action with chemo, radiation, combination of both, or what have you, or maybe not suggest any of that. We haven't heard. And so he also wants to take an all-natural approach. So he's been researching that with curcumin and things like that. So while we were up in Atlanta, because a big birthday party for Caleb turning 2, we'll be celebrating that at up in Atlanta on Saturday. But we thought that we would do several things while we were up there. I hadn't been up there in a while. We're going to see my buddy Phil, give him big, big hugs and support. We're going to go to a retirement party for one of Jen's teacher friends that she worked with for 7 years. We're going to go visit my dad north of Atlanta because he hadn't seen Lily yet because we've been on the road so much. And so we got a lot of stuff we got to do that we want to do. And it's a lot of it's family-oriented, so you know how important that is. And but not really work-related. So let me see if I'll, regarding Phil, yeah, and I've been meaning to do that, post maybe his email address or maybe even his physical address. Y'all can send him cards. Appreciate that, Christmas chick. That's a great idea to uplift him during this time. And so I'll see if I can at least get an email address for you so y'all can send him uplifting emails, let you know that he is in your prayers, thoughts, good vibes, send him way, whatever your beliefs are, Phil needs it. So we will. I'll try to do that. Thank you very much for suggesting that. That's a great idea, and I've been meaning to do that. So again, today, Chicken Doctor Peter Brown will be answering some questions from our Facebook page, and then we will talk about heat-related illness. And then tomorrow, no show. Wednesday there'll be a show because we are going to be talking about essential oils and how to use them and what different oils are for. And then Thursday we've got Richard Frutenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, and the no-show Friday or Monday. So you and I can not only just enjoy Memorial Day weekend with family and friends and loved ones, we'll be celebrating Caleb's 2-year birthday. We're really excited about that, and Jen's really excited about that. And a no-show Monday. So we hope that you will have a good weekend celebrating and honoring the veterans, and that's what it's all about. It's not about cooking wieners on the grill. We do that to celebrate, but why you're cooking wieners and bratwurst and burgers on the grill, maybe a little baked chicken, take a moment and of silence or think while you're enjoying the weekend of why you can do it. Why can I be free here in my backyard and not have to worry about snipers hitting me? Well, I don't know. There are an awful lot of drones used in America now, but that's another topic. And why can I do this? And it's because of the veterans that are out there that have kept us safe from tyranny. So we appreciate them. So do that this weekend. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy your family and friends. Have a great time. But don't forget, especially on Monday, what it is all about. Like Bard Rock puts, all gave some, and some gave all. And, I was talking to somebody the other day about, are there different levels of heroes? Okay. Do the heroes of World War II, World War I, and Vietnam, are they different level heroes than heroes of the Iraq War or the Desert Storm or the war in Afghanistan? Are there different levels because of the technology? You know, we have ground troops all over the world, but I mean, you think about having to storm Normandy and all those places and D-Day and the bombers back then. That, you know, you couldn't just sit on a ship 4,000 miles away, push a button, and have a missile go right into a window where you want to take somebody out. Are there different levels of heroes? We were discussing that about some of the things that they had to go through and tolerate in World War II, World War I, Civil War, Vietnam versus war today, which is a little bit more high tech, but there's still door-to-door combat, there's still hand-to-hand combat, there's still troops on the ground. There was an interesting discussion about looking back at World War II and looking at some of those videos and documentaries back then of what those folks had to go through versus the technology wars we have today. So as somebody, it was a very interesting conversation, and I chalked it up to being titled that. Are there different levels of heroes? Hey, what is a hero? When I did public safety training for a long time, and we talked about 9/11, and we talk about the firefighters and the EMS workers and the police officers that were killed during 9/11 in New York. And we often talked about that. And when I was training healthcare providers, talking about that, we talked about them being heroes and what is a hero, and we talked about the seriousness of that, and the fact that hindsight's always 20/20, but we would educate them on scene safety. Nothing like that had ever happened before on American soil, let alone, I guess, anywhere else on the planet. So there may not, yes, the scene may not be safe. And if the scene's not safe, you don't go in. And we talked about that. Hindsight's 20/20. I said many a times that if the head honcho of the New York Fire Department, if that happened again, did the same thing he did then would it be the wrong decision, Because, what is the definition of saving a life? And I'm going to kind of off on not a tangent, but on a different related issue. But I found it very important when we were doing training health and safety folks. And so we talked about that. We were like, how many lives were saved by the 400 firefighters that were there that day? Were 400 lives saved? Well, then it goes back to, what's your definition of saving a life? Is your saving a life standing in the lobby saying, get out, everybody get out, come on, get out, when people are already getting out, does that constitute saving a life? Or is your idea of saving a life finding someone who's already dead, no heartbeat, no breathing, shocking them back to life, if you will? Is that saving a life? Is holding pressure on a stab wound so they don't bleed out saving a life, bringing them back with shocking them to fear, or standing in a stairwell going, get out, is that saving a life? If standing in a stairwell and saying get out is saving lives, then they probably saved a lot of people that day. But if you, depending on what your definition of saving a life is. So were 400 lives saved that day that justified 400 dead firemen? And do you think those firemen's wives care now that they are labeled a hero? No. They would rather have those firemen with them cuddling at night, playing with the kids, than having a statue honored to them. I mean, that's just fact. I mean, I've did this for 8 years. I've trained public safety officials, EMT, paramedic, firefighters, the whole nine yards. And we talked about this religiously when we talked about scene safety, because it was a hard row to hoe when you talk about saving lives. And it boils down to what your definition of saving a life is, and how many on that day, 911, if you had 400 firefighters on scene, how many lives did they save just by standing in the hallway saying, get out, or setting up command inside the buildings or what have you, versus if your definition of saving a life is shocking them back to life once their heart has stopped beating due to cardiac arrest. So it's a touchy situation, because you don't want to take the label hero off of anybody, but at the same time, you want to teach these EMTs, paramedics, and firefighters that, scene safety is very important. I'm going to share with this one time, back when I was a paramedic full-time for about 7 years and a firefighter as well, and I'll give you an example of scene safety. It was a very interesting call. We were driving back to the fire station from a call, and we drove by, actually, the scene we were just about to get called to. We drove by. It was a Habitat for Humanity home that they were building, a lot of volunteers. There was a concrete truck in the street. I think they were either paving the driveway or laying concrete for the driveway or sidewalk or something like that. And we were like, we even mentioned it. Say, hey, look, Habitat for Humanity is building a house over here. We get no sooner than we got back to the fire station, we got called back. And at the time we got the call, we didn't know it was that scene. But plugged in the address in the computer, the ambulance got there, and we pulled up to the road we just drove down. Really weird. And to the same Habitat Humanity house. This was within probably 15 or 20 minutes. We drive them by there. We pull up, and there is the gentleman that was the concrete worker. He had his big concrete truck there parked on the street. The house was down kind of a little of an embankment, and the driveway went down the hill. And he was done with whatever he was doing. I don't remember if it was doing the sidewalk or paving the driveway or what have you. But we pulled up, and we saw the concrete man laying. Okay, he was laying in a puddle of water holding the pressure washer hose that he was washing his truck with. Okay, he was done with laying the concrete. He was then hosing off his truck. So he was standing in a puddle of water holding a hose that was still running with water. And he had a remote control. The remote control on his belt controlled the boom of the concrete truck. And he apparently pushed it the wrong way, too fast or too far, or didn't see the power lines above the truck. But the boom hit the power lines and ripped them, cut them, split them, whatever you want to say. And the power line that the boom from his concrete truck hit broke in two, and that power line fell right next to him while he stood in that puddle of water holding that hose. And when we pulled up, I'll tell you, the Habitat Humanity folks have tried to do everything to try to get to him, and they could not. They tried to lay some wood down over the puddle of water to try to get to him. They said as they walked on the wood, they could feel the electricity coming through it. They didn't want to get too close. You know, scene's not safe. You don't want to have two or three dead people there instead of one, because you don't want to have any dead heroes there too. That defeats the purpose. So we pulled up, and then the fire department pulls up, and we call Georgia Power, and we tell them the situation, and an hour later, Georgia Power pulls up. Maybe 45 minutes later, Georgia Power pulls up. Scene was not safe. Even if we could have done something for this gentleman, the scene was not safe. If I ran up there and tried to help him out of pure tunnel vision, and now I'm dead, well then, hey, you know, Jen has no husband, Caleb has no daddy, you know, that was a perfect example of scene safety. Again, we used when we were training folks. Scene safety, and literally 45 minutes later, it may have been an hour, Georgia Power rolls up and they clamp, you know, two ends of, you know, they don't have to turn big power switch off. They got things they can clip on the lines that'll deaden a section in between them. Once that was done, then we could actually, in fact, while we were waiting an hour later, we called the county coroner and had him come on out too, because there was obviously nothing we could be able to do for this gentleman. So sad situation. People tried to help initially, but again, the scene wasn't safe. So just very interesting how. So are there different levels of heroes? Is a hero that was a ground troop in World War II, or maybe that was there at D-Day? Or what have you, a different level hero than somebody in a ship pushing a button that's going to send a missile 3,000 miles away and into a window. It's very interesting conversation. It was heartfelt and very interesting when it came up this week. But nonetheless, enjoy your family this week and remember the heroes on Memorial Day of why we can celebrate in peace this holiday weekend. And if you have somebody that's in the service, then we honor them and we appreciate them 100%. So remember that this holiday. No worries there. So alrighty, what we're going to do is we're going to bring on Peter Brown right now, and we're going to answer a few questions from our Facebook page and that we posted yesterday, and then we'll get on to heat-related illness in chickens, of course, with Peter Brown. Peter, welcome back to the show. We're so glad you're here.
Hey, Andy. How are you doing today?
I am doing fine, getting ready to celebrate a week from today, Memorial Day, and very, very honored to be able to celebrate that. And we're going to do a combination heading up to Atlanta. Still plan on doing the show, like I was telling folks, most of this week, but seeing my dad, seeing my buddy Phil, that's got the cancer, going to see a retirement party for one of Jen's good friends. So we're going to have a lot of family and friend activities to celebrate the whole week. Including Monday with Memorial Day, so we're looking forward to that. I thought, Peter, today, since I did have a lot of people post some questions, that we would kind of cover those first, and without having a whole show on one question or two questions, we can answer them with best we can, and then we'll get into the heat-related illnesses, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah, whatever
And then end up probably...
Whatever direction you want to head in, fine with me.
And then if we don't get to heat-related illnesses, I know you won't be available. No, yeah, you will be available. No, next Monday there's no show. And then the Monday the 3rd, you wouldn't be here. So if we have to, we can postpone the heat-related to another show. But I really want to get these questions answered from
sure.
the folks that posted on our Facebook page. So I'll go ahead and scroll down, and we'll get started with some of these. Let me scroll back up here. I think this was the first one we posted. So we'll just start at the top. Okay, we'll start at the top. I have two questions. Okay? I'm building a coop. How big should the roost be to keep the feet healthy? And is it okay to use a plastic box for the nesting boxes? So, how big does the roost need to be? And then is it okay to use plastic boxes for their nesting box?
Okay. Well, let me answer the plastic for the nesting boxes.
Sure.
It's just fine. They work out very, very well. I don't even know if it's – it's probably not on the new web store because some of the stuff from the old site didn't transfer over. And but they are available out there. Front cover and the perch for putting it on a 5-gallon plastic bucket. So they're very appropriate. In actuality, can help cut down on problems with mites and that kind of stuff because there's really almost no place in the nest box for them to hide, depending on what kind of bedding you're using.
Easy to clean?
Easy to clean. You can take them off
yeah.
the wall, wash them out. You don't even really have to take them off the wall. The way these operate is that in the backside on a triangular basis, you'll put three screws directly into the wall with big flat washers so it doesn't pull the screw out through the plastic bucket. And so those wouldn't be sharp at all, so it wouldn't harm the bird. Gives the bucket a lot of stability up against the wall. You put whatever you want in for bedding, snap the front perch onto the cover, snap the cover onto the front of the bucket. It's secured with, I believe, this particular one with some wire ties and that kind of thing. They don't fit every bucket, but I believe at the last time I talked to the manufacturer, they fit like a Home Depot type bucket, Lowe's bucket, and a few others. All buckets are not created equal. While they may look the same, some have a larger taper. So the bottom of the bucket's actually smaller, and then it tapers up, and the top is bigger. So if you're going to buy some from Lowe's or whatever and you have one of these units, take it with you, make sure it fits nice and tight, snaps into place, and go with it from there. There are some nest boxes out of Europe that are being sold here now in this country. I had the opportunity to have the inside track on that stuff, and due to the way the nature of the business that we have and the way that we operate and stuff, it just didn't it didn't work out for me that I wanted to take that whole line on, and you know, we don't, you know, at this point we're not
right.
we don't want to invest money at this point in the game into a big marketing system to try to market those products. I've had enough trouble just selling the metal ones that I have manufactured for me that are, you know, really neat but don't sell well. So I didn't want to take on anything else that is going to sit around and, you know, waste inventory dollars. But they're quite handy to have. You know, you could the one with the bucket, you could take the front off of it, scoop out all the shavings, get some disinfectant, wipe it out real quick, 1, 2, 3, you're done, put the front back on, resecure it, and you're done, and you've cleaned it all out, and that kind of thing. The only drawback to that type of a situation is that it doesn't keep the birds from nesting in there at night. And, you know, some people don't care, you know, and that's fine, whichever way you want to go with on that. Now, as far as the perch material is concerned, the size of it, some birds are different than others is what I've been finding. Some birds like to wrap their feet around, and some are perfectly happy sitting flat on it with their feet under, you know, under themselves and their feet flat on the perch material. So whatever works best for this particular individual's birds, but you don't want to have something that's too small so that the claws wrap around and injure the bird. And you don't want to use a material that is going to be easily splintered or have sharp edges or anything like that. Now, we're going to use in our coop here a flat plastic material. It's very hard, easily taken off and washed, disinfected, put back on, will not splinter, and it's flat. I'm going to say it's at least 3 inches wide, and these are all Bantams and stuff, and I think they'll perch on it real well. If not, I'll have to change it, but and I've got a smaller plastic that is not quite as heavy as this other one, we will eventually be selling that material. We're not quite sure what the length of it will be yet. Shipping issues are always a problem with that kind of stuff that's narrow and long. But probably something that will fit inside of a triangular post office shipping container without sticking out all over the place, so that way it can go priority mail without breaking the bank. But any of those kinds of materials. So you know, if you're going to use a 2x4 or you're going to use something along those lines, you want to make sure that the edges are well rounded. Any splinters, you know, or issues with parts that may splinter on you, you want to make sure you take care of them, because that leads to bumblefoot, and bumblefoot is a real nasty issue. 2 weeks ago or so, we did a seminar over in Cape May, New Jersey, for creatures and stuff, and I had some photos that I passed around. I didn't have this particular group of in my slide set, but I printed them out on a glossy paper so that everybody could get the real issue of what it was. And I think quite a few people were appalled at bumblefoot left unchecked, how nasty it can get. So I try to stop those kind of issues before they even get started. So one of them is to get, you know, pick a good perch material, something that isn't going to splinter, something that the birds feel comfortable on. Mostly with birds, it's stability. If the roost is solid, and you know, when they jump up on it and they don't have to do the balancing act to try to stay on, you know, they'll go right to it and they'll perch and they'll be done with it. So as far as that's concerned, I think it really doesn't matter, as long as the I don't think there's any right and wrong. I've seen it go both ways. I've seen birds that didn't like something too wide, and you know, bear in mind, the wider you make it, while they will go to it and roost on it, then they're going to, you know, they're going to leave their droppings behind, and it becomes a cleanup issue at that level. So you might want to keep that in mind. The material that we have is going to be pretty hard for them. The back end is going to hang over the back of it, the way I see it. And,
right.
I could be wrong, but we're using some different techniques for a few things here. And once it's all completed, we will put up either pictures or a video to let everybody see what's going on. We're even looking at having a live feed in the coop so that people can go and look and see what they're doing and so on. So. That's something else we're looking at here.
Cool beans. Awesome. Can't wait to see pictures of it. Got another one here. Is there any material that should not be used in building a coop? And I'm thinking maybe, because some people I hear often on the road, can we use treated lumber? Can we use cedar, you know, wood? I've got a bunch of cedar. They build houses out of cedar. You know. So I think more lines of that than something else.
Yeah.
The
cedar issue I've never really had to deal with. So I really, you know, being honest about it, I can't really speak to that. But I would just say that if you're using a lot of cedar in a coop, the odor that it gives off, you know, might not be healthy. If it's an irritant, you've got no material that is going to be an outright irritant to the birds. Their respiratory system is very sensitive. So if they're cooped up in there at night, any time of the year, it doesn't really matter. Breathing something that is going to be an irritant to them that might, you know, lend itself to more respiratory issues than a person might want to handle. So
right.
I would probably staying away from anything that's considered aromatic. As far as salt treated is concerned, there are no detriments that I know of directly. I've seen it used time in, time out.
You have to.
You know, they've moved away from the arsenic-based materials that used to be in it for obvious EPA regulations and rules. So I don't. You know, I am not going to be the expert on that particular thing. I can only tell you, you know, I have chosen to use it only in one area of our particular coop, and that's a separation wall that is going to separate some outdoor cats that need shelter on the opposite end of the coop, and it just two by two staves that you would use on a deck.
Right.
And we've taken the plate and put it down across the bottom, and then they're about 2 inches apart when you're all done with it. And it's a little bit higher than what you would call, I guess, a knee wall. This is right about chest high, so from there to the ceiling. So it wouldn't have an effect on the birds. They'll really have no contact with it. The cats won't have any contact with it. I saw it as something that I could use in that coop and didn't have to paint, and would be able to disinfect it readily without any detriment to the wood or anything else. So from that standpoint, I don't see it being an issue. If I was going to use it for support use or something like that, I think I'd go ahead and do that.
Okay, excellent. The next one here is from Elaine. She has 2-year-old hens that lay eggs with extremely watery white. Why is that?
Okay. Sometimes that's a genetic issue. Just the nature of that particular breed. Watery whites have always been an issue, even on the commercial side. They don't want birds that produce eggs that have a higher degree of watery albumin. You don't want that either in a hatching egg because of the balancing act of trying to get the moisture out of the egg without having sticky chicks that stick to the shell and just don't make it out, so you end up with deadened shell and that kind of stuff, or late deads and that kind of thing. A bout with bronchitis can cause it. If the bird's ever had a respiratory issue with the virus infectious bronchitis, that can do it as well. Excessive water intake, you might see this and do see this in the summertime, more so than you would see it in the wintertime as a general rule. Overconsumption of salt, too much tuna fish being fed to them, too much cat food, things of that nature. Anything high in salt is detrimental to them, would cause them to retain more water than necessary, and it'll end up showing up in the albumin of the egg. So any one of those issues, could be causing it. Really hard to put your finger on it unless you're going to be diligent about eliminating one thing at a time, looking at what you're doing, looking at your feed. And I know that some people say, well, I buy the feed at the feed store. Well, there have been several cases here in the last 6 months where folks have bought feed from the feed store. One of them is a client of mine over in Virginia, and they've had excess of salt in the feed. It happens, and it might happen more often than people might realize, because by the time you realize there may be an issue, you're on to the next bag of feed or the next batch of feed or whatever. And so it does happen that way. So it can come in the form of the feed. It can come in the form of feeding tuna fish, cat food, dog food, to your birds, even as treats. We've talked about it before, about its detriment to them, causing right ventricular heart failure, causing ascites besides, which is a pressure differential in the venous system, and what we used to call water belly, so the belly fills up with water. Like congestive heart failure in humans, the heart doesn't have the capacity to pump all of this stuff. Fast-growing birds, we see it in. They see it a lot in broiler birds in the commercial poultry industry. And that kind of thing. So any one of those things can cause it. And you have to try to, again, play and and figure out what it is that's causing it. Maybe a genetic thing. If it's the bronchitis or the genetics, there's nothing you can do about it. But in the summertime, we expect to see it, because when birds are out there in the heat, they're going to consume a lot more water as a general rule on a real, real hot day than they will food. So.
Right. Okay, let's see here. I have a rooster that will not leave my broody hen alone. Keep flogging her and pecking her. Is it time to think about stew pot and dumplings? or is there another alternative? So I was thinking, I don't know, I mean, like I said, you know, separating him from her or separating her and her brood from him, especially once they hatch, and maybe the other hens too that aren't going to be very pleasant, but there's her issue. She's got a rooster that is aggravating, pecking, and flogging her broody mama.
Yeah, you know, we see this all the time. When I say we talk about it on the show, you know, the birds that are aggressive just beating up the hens and or hen or whatever the case may be. You know, certainly if they have the opportunity and facilities to separate them out, that you know, takes care of that issue real quick and still leaves them a rooster to produce hatching eggs whenever they need them. For me personally, from my perspective, the stew pot's probably the last place, you know, that I would venture to go.
Hey, Doc, can you put that mic a little bit closer to your lips?
Yep, that should be a lot better because it was way away.
Okay.
Just one of those
Thank
things.
Thank you.
Sorry
they
about that.
No worries. Got it.
Yeah, well, I'll start over. You know, if they have the facilities to put him in a separate pen, that's fine. That mitigates the situation. But I suspect if they had already had that situation, they probably would have done that. So bearing that in mind, I would opt for a pair of pinless peepers. I think that will get his undivided attention and make him very very leery of stepping on anybody's back and pushing them to the ground and beating them to death and pecking on them and everything else. As a matter of fact, it might turn the tables a little bit. So if this particular party would send me an email at chickendr@firststatevetsupply.com, I will send a couple of pairs complimentary.
That's awesome.
Try
yeah,
that.
We'll definitely.
Yeah, why not? You know, and then then after that, if it doesn't work, they can do whatever they choose from there. But there aren't a whole lot of other issues other than separating him out and putting these peepers on. But I do not know of an instance, and I, you know, because I don't know, and I don't get all the feedback from all the folks that buy
right.
these things or I send them to. But I would venture to say that the majority of the time that these things do work. I have seen it work, you know, many times. So. It's worth a shot. It isn't going to cost that individual anything to try it. So,
yep, very good. They send him an email. Perfect. Tara wants to know, how should an animal attack injury be cared for? I have one hen that was attacked by a raccoon. Mm-hmm. One eye is gone. Lots of lacerations to the head. How do I keep it clean and try to prevent infection? What do I need to look for in regards to deciding if I need to put her down or not? I'm new to chickens and new to their health care.
Okay. These things are always, always tough because there is an attachment of these folks to their birds, no question about that. I've seen this many, many times. The eye issue, the eye's gone, nothing you can do about it other than to keep the area clean. I would not use anything on the tissue that is going to be overly astringent, like iodine or those kinds of things. If I was going to clean it, pick a solution like a betadine or something like that. Peroxide should be okay, because what you don't want to do is cause more tissue death with the product that you're trying to clean it with. That you know you're not helping the situation. You know by doing that. And then I would put triple antibiotic ointment wherever these lacerations are. Clean them, and if they're in a position where they can be covered, where the bird won't peck the stuff off and tear it all apart, I would probably cover it, and then change that every day, and just keep it clean. Keep the triple antibiotic. Most of these situations, if they're caught early and a real bad infection doesn't set in, they turn out successful. So you have a bird that's blind in one eye and everybody goes on. The issue of what to look for, that's a tough one because, if the bird is not able to get around, if you have other birds that start picking on it, these are all issues that the owner has to deal with and make up their mind as to, you know, when this is a deal that's, you know, not going to go forward.
Yeah, I think it relates to, I mean, that goes for any living being or creature. You know, quality of life, pain, you know. I mean, obviously, if they you know, they're, that's why a lot of chicks are cold when they have leg injuries. If you think, you know, legs getting away from predators, legs scratching for food, legs, you know, defending themselves. So, I think even with this, the answer, like with anything, if it's grandma or your loved one or your chicken or your dog, it's like, okay, you know, are they just absolutely miserable? No quality of life. They can't even get over to the feed to eat. So they're, I mean, dying of starvation. Who wants that? Or just having seizures or seem to be in pain all the time. So there's that quality of life issue / in pain. Mm-hmm. Issue that, you know, what you may one day have to make the decision. And so folks that listen to the show on a regular basis know that that's really not your call or my call with that. And you're always about that. You know, that's, I'll help you as much as I can. Your job is to help keep them healthy, keep them alive. But yep. Like you said, that's something that probably every chicken owner will have to go through if they keep chickens for any length of time.
Yeah, or any other animal for that matter. I mean, it is a quality of life issue. If she's looking for a different sign, you know, an infection that won't go away, skin that won't heal, that continues to ooze no matter what you do with it. Now, I would say this to this particular individual. I would seek out an antibiotic to give to this bird, because I think that will go a long way to keeping an infection from coming into the picture here. You know, you just have to keep an eye on it. But an antibiotic, I choose something like cephalexin. Amoxicillin might be okay, cephalexin being better in my book for soft tissue issues, which this would be. And the reason I would say that is the cephalexin has a tendency to get out to the periphery, to the edges, so to speak. It's used in other animals for skin issues all the time. And a lot of other antibiotics, while they're good at respiratory issues or gut issues, they don't make it out of those areas very well. So the concentration of a particular antibiotic out at the skin level is very minute for other products, whereas cephalexin would be quite a bit of it, and it's used all the time for skin issues in dogs and cats and other species of animals. So I would seek that out and use that in conjunction with cleaning the wounds and the triple antibiotic ointment, and I think, you know, it'll go by. We've done this, and I say we, I've guided people to do this, can't tell you how many times. It's just an overwhelming number of times. These things happen when you have animals. You think you've got them secured. Once you think you've got it all secured, think again. That's what I tell people all the time. Think again, because these animals that are trying to get in, a raccoon, a fox, a skunk, or whatever, they're hungry, and that's all their brain is telling them. And they're going to look for that little spot that you thought, as a human, they weren't going to get through, but they did. And it ended up to be these kinds of situations or whatever the case may be. In this coop out here, they're going to be locked up tight in a cat's butt at night. I'm not worried about a nighttime predator. I would be more concerned about a daytime predator. So we've gone to great lengths to take care of that. For instance, just a simple thing, you know, the gate to go in and out of the enclosure, okay? Went a foot and a half down with concrete all the way across, so that the bottom of the gate just barely touches the concrete, okay? So there's nothing can get under that thing during the daytime. And if they want to get under, they're going to have a foot and a half down and come under, and, you know, that's probably not going to happen. So all these kinds of things are important things to try to outthink what I consider to be the predator enemy. But anyway, that's what I would do with that particular bird. As far as anything else as to when it's time to put it down, that's up to them.
And someone in the chat room wants to know, how tight is that cat butt? Okay, moving right along. Moving right along here. That got a chuckle out of several people. So let's see. Okay, this is a great segue. what goes into a chicken first aid kit? Now, we've talked about this before in the past many times, and there's a combination there. There'll be a difference. There may be the first aid kit for injuries and trauma, but then just as equally as important, if not more important, because if you think back how many have an injury or trauma versus how many have some type of medical issue, it may be much more on the medical side than trauma side as you go on your chicken keeping life. So so we'll put this into two questions. What would go into a chicken first aid kit? And then if you'll talk a little bit about your emergency medicine kit for Monica.
Sure. Yeah, we've been working on I say we, me and Tammy, and I've got a friend of mine that puts his two cents in as well. And we've been working on different kits. The emergency medical kit, medicine kit, came out first. And I was working on two other assignments simultaneously. One is tube feeding, which is almost three-quarters of the way done, only because I decided to add an additional artist rendering of how to do it with a tube feeding device, a metal unit that goes on a syringe, and then also the tube, so that you'll be able to choose either one, whichever fits your particular situation, whichever is going to be easiest for the individual. So I'm just waiting for the second picture to be done. And these are all color. Everything is going to be laminated in this particular kit. So and then I was working on the what you might call a trauma kit, and what have you. And that is probably the most difficult one because of all of the things you could think of to put in there. And it raised the cost of it up so high that I had to walk away from it for a little bit and go back and regroup. And so I'm trying to come up with something that is more palatable. But, you know, for an emergency trauma kit, you know, obviously a triple antibiotic ointment would be good. Some sutures would be good. Maybe a couple of, you know, syringes, some of the finer ones, up to some that are a little bit bigger as far as the needles are concerned, so that you could administer an antibiotic and with a syringe and a needle if you had to. You know, some gauze, some vet wrap, things of that nature. And, you know, I had this other kit put together, and then when we started putting together the overall cost of it, it was just overwhelming. You know, when you start getting above, you know, $15 to $20, you know, it slows people down in their want to have something in case. You know, I think if you go through the average house, you'd probably be hard pressed to find a box of Band-Aids in most places, if you know what I'm saying. And it's not because necessarily always we don't always want to pay for them. We don't think of it, you know. And I've been victim of that myself. Look high and low for a Band-Aid, you know. And you know, now due to my own medical situations, you know, being, you know, I can pick a little bit of skin off my finger that's dried, and well, first thing you know, it's a bleeding Mary. So I gotta. I actually want to go on the road now. I carry them in my bag, but I may even carry one in my pocket every now and then too. So it's just mind over matter sometimes. But you get too far out price wise, and they'll sit there and they're not going to sell, and that's not what I'm interested in doing. The other issue was getting sutures in here that had a decent date on them, and I spoke to that before. Sutures are an issue because they're dated, you know, and. I need something that's got as long a date as possible, and in searching around for the particular type of suture that I needed for this kit, everything was, at that point with the people that I deal with, was somewhat short dated. And that one's on a back burner. But those are some of the things. When you start looking at, you know, people say, well, what about pain? Your best bet is an aspirin, okay? The Bayer brand, and I say Bayer because they are the gold standard. People like to use the generic because you don't have to pay as much, and that's your choice. But I always say a Bayer brand baby aspirin because you know what you're getting for the most part. It was their product from the get-go. If anybody knows anything about aspirin, it's them. And so that's why I say that. But giving aspirin to chickens is no big deal. For instance, giving 3 to 4 81-milligram aspirin per day, no big deal. Won't hurt them one bit. And it's used in the commercial poultry industry all the time. As a matter of fact, I have several bottles of it here that are actually liquid. And the only thing that's kept me from putting it out there is getting the time to sit down, figure out how I break it down from a one-liter bottle into a bottle that's usable for the people that I deal with who can get a small bottle of it. And then so much of that goes in a gallon of water without being overwhelming. So it's just, you know, one more thing to do. But so if you get into it, you know, the box, and you want to put in Medicam, now you're talking to raising it up another $15, $18. You know, who wants to pay for that? You know, again, another dated product. So you buy it and you put it up on a shelf. And I've had Medicam in here more times than you got hair on your head. And, you know, I end up giving it away because it's either outdated or it's so close to being outdated that you can't sell it. Nobody wants it. So, you know, I don't stock it anymore. I can get it. You know, take me a couple, 3 days, but it's not a big deal. So, it, you know, what you put, you know, what do you put into the kit? That becomes the problem at the end of the day. But we're working on that one, and we'll get it solved. We'll get it at a reasonable price that everybody can hopefully live with and have it on the shelf to do. But basically, you know, I may put an antibiotic in there. I don't know yet. I have to look at, you know, the cost of doing that. It's a bottle with, you know, maybe half a dozen pills in it. Something to get you started. None of these kits were ever designed, okay, to take you long term. When I deal with folks on the phone, it's always been, you know, hey, you know, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to use. What do you have? And the proverbial answer 99% of the time is nothing. And so that's why how these came along. As a matter of fact, it was the audience here, people listening to the show, that requested these things. That's how they've all come about. And I'm glad to do it. I just got to do it so that it's equitable for the people that want to buy them and myself as well. So, but those are some of the things. A triple antibiotic ointment is good to have in there, some sutures, some gauze, some vet wrap, some Betadine, you know, and I've looked into that. How big a bottle of Betadine do you put in? That means I have to buy Betadine in large quantities and break it down into small quantities. And, you know, they become issues, again, with all of these other problems that are associated with it that we ran into with Oxine and, you know, the whole nine. That's why that's not in there anymore. And so it is a little bit of a problem, but we'll come along with it. But those are some of the things that I would like to see in it, the sutures, the triple antibiotic ointment, okay, the gauze, the vet wrap, possibly an antibiotic for, you know, for an internal use such as the cephalexin or something like that. But we're looking at it. That's what I would suggest that be in it, at least at a minimum. I had other things that I was going to put in because I've run into areas where large pieces of skin and feathers were ripped off of birds. And the problem with that is that because it's so exposed and trying to cover it, so we were looking at poultices to put on these things, and it just became too expensive. So hopefully I've answered that question roundabout way.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
No worries. Okay, let's let me get back over here to where we were at. Let's see. The next one is... see if I want to write this one here. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about, this is what they say, Vicky, egg yolk peritonitis? Little information about it on the Internet.
Well, one of the reasons that that there isn't much information on it is that it's hard to write about something you can't see. It's really quite simple. We've talked about this on the show before. We'll go over it again here. Egg yolk peritonitis generally happens when there's a hormonal imbalance or a rough handling of the bird at the time that the ovum is ovulated from what we call the ovary tree. If the infundibulum, which is the beginning of the oviduct, which is funnel-shaped, is in the wrong place or it doesn't move hormonally under the next ovum to be ovulated, then it will end up dropping that ovum into the body cavity. We call the ovum at that point what most people would call a yolk, okay? And so that yolk, ovum, gets dropped into the body cavity. As a one-time deal, generally, it's not a big deal. The body will wall it off and try to reabsorb it. If it doesn't, it'll calcify it over time, and it'll just sit in the bottom of the body cavity, and everybody's fine. The problem with it is, if that recurs on a continual basis, therein lies the huge problem that you have with egg yolk peritonitis. And the bird starts dropping more ovums or yolks into the body cavity than the body can handle and absorb and wall off. If you have a good prolific layer, a bird that's laying almost every day, and she stops laying, and she's dumping eggs into the yolks into the body cavity, there's going to be a problem. There isn't. That bird is probably not going to survive. I mean, it's just You know, it's just inevitable, and there's no way around it other than doing some sort of surgery on a bird, and you know, most of those don't turn out good either. So, and here's the other issue: if you were to find somebody, and you were willing to pay the money to do surgery on a bird like this, what's to keep it from happening again?
Sure.
You know, what's to keep it from happening again? I had somebody here on the internet not too long ago that I contacted me in relation to a bird that seemed to be egg-bound. And I worked with this person. I may have mentioned this on an earlier show, but this happened within the last month or so. And so, you know, I figured the person was willing. Let me show them that there's no way you're going to take your finger and put it in the vent of a bird and open that oviduct and get that egg out. Not happening. The only way that's going to happen is if that sphincter muscle that holds that oviduct shut, okay, is so weak that you're going to be able to get your finger through it. Not happening. It just doesn't work that way. And, you know, I've had people, send me emails, said, I've checked the vent, I can't feel an egg. No, you're not going to. Not going to. Most of the time you can palpate it under the belly to the side, and you can push in enough, and if it's a big enough egg, you usually can palpate it and you can feel it. But you're not going to remove it with your finger. Not today, not tomorrow, not next week. And that's just the way it is. And I know that's not about egg yolk peritonitis, but I'm trying to give people an idea of how this stuff works. It just isn't going to work that way. The vent itself is the opening. The cloaca is the common urogenital duct. That means the urine and feces come down through there, sexual activity takes place there, and egg laying takes place there. Okay, and I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, cloaca is Greek for cesspool. And that's just what it is. It's where everything comes together at one time or another. But you putting your finger in there and getting it into the oviduct so that you can get an egg out and open that sphincter muscle, in my opinion, it ain't happening. And it didn't happen for this person either. They gave up.
Right.
You know, and I guided them, sent them pictures of, where the oviduct was in relation to the cloaca, all that stuff. Sent all of that. And they became so frustrated they put the bird down. So, same thing with egg yolk peritonitis. We'll get back to that. This is an anomaly that happens. Lots of times we see this either in real young birds or real old birds. Usually young birds will recover because they're just getting their hormonal balance together. Older birds have a tendency not to recover. They stop laying eggs, and you don't notice it other than the fact that the bird has stopped laying an egg. And after a week or two, first thing you know is they start to waddle like a duck, walking more upright, more white in their droppings, which would be the urine, because the egg mass is putting more pressure on the kidneys, and that kind of stuff, okay? You may even notice more labored breathing, because as the body cavity gets filled up, guess what's in the body cavity? Air sacs, okay? So when we have, it makes it even more difficult to breathe. So once it happens, I'm not sure I am answering this question the way a person might want it answered, but that's the way it is, and that's why you don't see a whole lot written on it, because bear in mind that the majority of the research and everything that's done comes out of the commercial poultry industry, and the only time that they know that at all if a bird is an internal layer is after it's dead. And I can assure you, unless there's a huge mortality spike in any egg-laying operation, none of those birds are opened up every day like they should be. They're not going to take the time. There may be some places in the country where they do that, so there may be some exceptions to the rule that I'm obviously not aware of. But when I was in that particular business, unless there was a huge spike in mortality, it was just today's mortality, and that's the way it goes. And, you know, they went into the mortality pile, and that was it. Now, if it was a big, huge problem, then we would start, you know, really looking at these things. And in most cases, they don't have the personnel, they don't have the time, and they're not going to take the time.
Right.
This is an issue.
Okay. And we'll follow this up. So I'm talking about the eggs. We've talked this a lot of times, too, but I guess it's worth repeating. And one of our chickens laid an egg with no shell right before my very eyes. And here's where it adds some interesting information. She had been sitting on eggs until a possum got them all and gave her a few scratches in the process. This was one of the very first eggs she laid after 2 weeks of no laying at all. She seems okay now, but I had a rooster die about 6 weeks after the possum attack in the fall, so I can't help but to worry. So she stopped laying for 2 weeks, more than likely due to the stress of the predator attack and coming face to face with that possum. She's now, I guess, gotten more comfortable. She's starting to lay, and the first one just happened to be the no-shell, soft-shell egg. I would assume that these will return back to laying absolutely normal. It's just as her egg-making machine is starting to get revamped and start working again, these little things need to get worked out. And so we'll see what Peter has to say about this.
Well, you know, there's always other things that it could be. You know, she didn't really elaborate on, you know, the possum attack directly on this particular bird. A few scratches is nothing compared to what some of the things I've seen, you know, from possum and raccoon and other attacks. So I don't think up front that it's just the fact that she got scared and stopped laying eggs. For one day, maybe. But their system generally doesn't always work in that kind of fashion. What I think one of the tip-offs for me here, and there wasn't any further elaboration, but this bird had been sitting on eggs for 2 weeks. My guess is not eating very much or eating nothing, because they have a tendency to do that, which would throw her calcium-phosphorus ratio out of balance there in the soft-shelled egg, okay, the egg without the shell. We see that all the time, and that generally is a problem with vitamin D3 and the calcium-phosphorus ratio. And again, we talked about this when we did the segment on vitamins and minerals and amino acids and all of those things. The absence of one begets the absence of another. That's that three-way intersection.
Right.
Where the vitamin D3 was coming down, the calcium was coming down, the phosphorus was coming down, and they all got to the middle and somebody was missing a little bit, and there it sits, and nothing gets done. Kind of like our government, I think. Oh, is that what we're talking about? No, don't talk about that. therein lies that particular problem. So I think it was related more to the fact that she might not have been kept up nutritionally due to the fact that she was sitting on these eggs. Even if she did get off from time to time and eat, usually they're not off of them very, very long. So at least that's my guess. And we also talked about the fact of supplementing birds prior to putting breeding birds together. And, you know, I see a lot of that, that goes on all the time. People don't supplement them, and they end up with a lot of abnormalities either in the offspring or whatever. So I would look at that as being the same thing. I don't think there was a big issue with the possum, unless it was a more severe attack than she is letting on in this particular question. But taking it for what it is, I would look at it as more of a nutritional thing, and I would think that if she wants to get her back up to speed, because if it were some sort of a bacterial infection that came across from the possum, I think you'd have a dead bird on your hands more so than anything else, you know, left untreated. The rooster, I can't speak to why he died.
Right.
Yeah.
No way. Yeah. Okay, let's see here. If you got a pen, I'm going to try to pronounce some of these illnesses and medications.
Hang on, let me get a pad here.
Alrighty, from Emma. This is a very technical question. She has a lot of information to give you to try to help you. Okay, so my chicken has been living indoors for 6 weeks with, hang on, let me get my glasses on. ILT, infectious laryngotracheitis.
Infectious laryngotracheitis, called LT.
There you
yep.
go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And mild TLT, avian rhinotracheitis. And this was confirmed by blood tests at the vet. She has had courses of antibiotics initially, as it was thought it was micro or myco. Myco, con, whatever. Just, she just puts MYCO.
Probably talking about mycoplasma, which would be mycoplasma galloseptica. That would be my, my issue.
Okay. So she had courses of antibiotics initially, as we thought it was micro. I now nebulize her twice a day with F10. F as in Frank. F10. Give her apple cider vinegar, garlic granules, probiotic powder. She's still very rattly and raspily, especially at night. She is fine in herself, very happy, eats and drinks fine. Is there anything else I can do for her? Any help would be greatly received. So it appears right now she's concerned about her still being very raspy when breathing, especially at night.
Okay. The ILT is a very, very, very prolific, meaning it spreads very quickly, virus. So I would be also interested in knowing, is this the only chicken she has? And I would be very surprised that this would be the only chicken that she has with it. I mean, it's not normal for this virus to attack one chicken in a coop. This is spread bird to bird very rapidly through the secretions coming out of the mouth, the nose, the eyes. So it'll spread easily through the drinking water, through the feed, bird to bird contact, one bird trying to preen another, all of these kinds of things. And it spreads like wildfire. In some states, this is a disease that if you're positive, your birds get put down. If this was North Carolina, those birds would be put down. And they may give you the option to vaccinate the birds and then keep the birds, but you will be quarantined from moving them off the premise or selling them to anyone. It doesn't transmit through the egg, so you could sell eggs from the flock to humans or otherwise. They would really need to be sanitized if they were going to another person who was going to breed from those eggs. Like I said, it doesn't pass through the egg, but it could be on the shell on the outside. So that would be a concern there. This particular disease resides in the bird's trachea, in its airway. And it destroys the airway and makes the trachea bleed. So if we look at a bird standing upright, the whole trachea is going downhill. Okay? So if you look at the glottis, which is in the bird's mouth, behind the tongue, in the floor of the mouth, that's the opening to the trachea, the airway, and it runs down the neck and goes into the body cavity where the wishbone or the clavicle is, where the crop is in that area, goes right down inside. So any bleeding that takes place is going downhill. And, I mean, any of us that have had a real severe cold can just remember all the mucus that runs down the back of your throat and how annoying it is, and you choke and cough and spit and everything else. Well, they can't choke, cough, and spit, and that's why they rattle. And that's why when they breathe, you get that rattling noise. And she already said this bird continues to have a rattle. So technically, this bird probably doesn't have a real severe case, but they start choking to death on their own blood because they can't clear it. It's going down, and we've also talked about this before when we did the segment on ILT. So it goes downhill, and the trachea itself is about, the diameter of a number two yellow lead pencil, but the outside part of it, okay? So you can see it's not very big in diameter, okay? That might even be a little bit large for some birds. But anyway, it's not huge. But as it goes down into and passes through the clavicle or wishbone and goes into the body cavity, they get smaller yet. They go down to the bronchi, which are not a whole lot bigger than maybe twice the diameter, if that, of the lead itself in that pencil, and then they go down to the mesobronchi, which are smaller than the lead to start with. So as it goes down, you can see, and this goes the same way why birds choke to death on mucus or anything, water that gets down in there that they can't get out. When you tube feed a bird and you don't do it properly and you're not using a tube and you're using a syringe and the bird goes to breathe and sucks that down in there, that's why they end up dying. I mean, it cuts the air off in a heartbeat. Boom, done. And they die just that quickly. You know, there's no musculature there. There's no diaphragm like you and I have to separate the abdominal cavity from the thoracic cavity, the chest cavity. So all of these things are an issue. So I'm just trying to explain where this thing lives, what it does, and why the mortality occurs. She's very lucky this bird is even alive at this point. I don't know what F10 is. That's not something I'm familiar with. The apple cider vinegar, probably helping to some degree. The garlic helping to some degree. The probiotic is only going to help with the gut. Won't do anything else. I really don't know what to tell her because there's always a possibility. You know, generally, rule of thumb is to vaccinate everybody, including the sick birds, and you take your chances. If this was a laboratory-confirmed case of ILT, you know, that concerns me a little bit. The avian rhinotracheitis, that's an offshoot of the ILT itself, if my memory serves me correctly. It's not a common thing that we get worried about. But the ILT is something to be worried about, no question about that. So I don't know what to tell her to do other than to vaccinate. And you vaccinate everybody at the same time, and then you sit back and you hope that nobody dies in the interim. That's the issue. It's a simple vaccination, not overly expensive. The vaccine itself is about $25. It's an eye drop. Put one drop, one eye, done. And you look for a take by looking for the blue in the top of the mouth because it's a blue dye in the diluent that comes with it. So you know you've done it right. When the bird has been properly vaccinated by just opening the mouth and then the nasal cleft in the top, it'll turn blue, and they've been vaccinated properly. And that should show up within less than an hour's time of vaccination. So that's something that you could see. Generally, with the vaccine that we use, it's tissue culture. It doesn't spread bird to bird. There's generally no real reaction in the bird. There may be some eye reaction. But other than that, you shouldn't see. Now, as far as a bird that has the disease, it depends on how bad it is, and that kind of thing. But still, the only way around it is to vaccinate. And that's a real tough issue. And if it's only one bird, if she's only got one, I don't know how it picked it up. You know, that's an issue. But that's about all. I would keep up the apple cider vinegar for sure. Yeah. That, you know, that may be her only saving grace by changing the pH of the blood. That may keep it from totally getting out of hand.
Okay, and we'll do this one. This one may wrap it up because I need to get out of here. But I thought this was a great question. Jennifer asked, last week, Doc, you were discussing the importance of the digestive system and probiotics. Are probiotics pretty much universal across species, or do we need to look for probiotics marketed specifically for poultry?
There are ones that are marketed specifically for poultry. The ones that I have seen are huge packages that, for the most part, need to be refrigerated. So they're very, very fragile compared to the probiotics that are out there that, you know, can be put on the shelf at room temperature and be stable. Years ago when I first started dealing with, and I wish I could remember the name of that Japanese company, but there was a Japanese company that had, you know, looked at probiotics and had one, and the biggest problem with it was unstable. The feed companies at the time, pelleting feed and that kind of thing, they were, it couldn't withstand the pellet mill, the high temperatures of the pellet mill. Today they've got them so that they withstand all of that. And there are others coming down the pike. We've been using the same one for many, many years. there. I'm not going to say at this point that any one is so much greatly better than the other. I think that using a probiotic, the main ingredient in most of them is Lactobacillus acidophilus. They properly used and used on a regular basis, they do a fantastic job. So I would really have to see where a different probiotic would really give you any greater benefit. And they look, they're keeping searching for different species of probiotics that are going to do different things. There's one now that has come out on the human side. It's available in Canada. It's supposed to be available here soon in the U.S., Lactobacillus reuteri. I never heard of it before until I did some research on chickens a while back, and I was picking up this thing. And I guess, let me go see what this is all about. Well, and I think I've mentioned it here before, but I'll mention it again, seeing as how that's the subject we're on. This will lower blood cholesterol naturally by taking it on a daily basis anywhere from 5 to 12%. That's huge. I mean, that's really a huge, huge deal. It has a double-blind study that's been done. There's research on humans being done with it. It's not just somebody saying, hey, take this and it works. They take your money and they go to the bank. So I'm a big fan of probiotics, always have been. This is just more proof that they do work. All of the research that I've seen, all of the photos, of electron microscope photos of intestines before and after, all show that the gut is much healthier with the probiotic than without. Getting back to the original question, if the probiotic has Lactobacillus acidophilus in it, I'm good to go with it, because that has been the mainstay of all of them. It is the one that attaches itself to the gut wall. It is the one that produces acid, takes up space on that gut wall so the bad guys can't set up shop and ruin things. The problem with it is, and I say this about all of these natural products, if you wait till you have a full-blown problem, most of them are not going to be very beneficial to you. It's the fact of using a product on a regular basis, whether it's human or otherwise, that is going to be the most beneficial to you. Waiting till you've got some huge problem and mortality, and even in humans, waiting till you've got full-blown case of stage 4 cancer of any kind and then expecting curcumin or anything else to take it all away is probably looking for a miracle. Doesn't mean it won't help keep it in check. You know, I've got somebody that I know that's got cancer too, and my thing to them was, when you're done with your chemo, maybe you ought to think about talking to your doctor and getting on some of this curcumin, okay, because it's known cancer fighter, so let's try to keep whatever it is you have from recurring or producing more cells, because it is what we call a product that causes apoptosis, which is cell death. So why wouldn't you take it? You know. So I would, you know, my answer there is, any probiotic that has a sufficient amount of Lactobacillus acidophilus in it would be a one that I would take, irregardless of what species it's made for.
Okay. And then there's one last one I've got to get in here. We've talked about it before, but she was definitely wanted to know if you could discuss just a little bit about gape worm.
Okay. Well,
gape worms.
They seem to be becoming more of a pain in the neck. They are tough to get rid of. And again, it's because of where it lives, okay, living in the airway of the bird, and in the mouth area, and so on. They have a tendency just be very difficult to get rid of, from a standpoint of, again, where they live, getting the medication, the wormer, to that particular area, you know, getting enough of it there to be of value. Again, this is one of those things where, the host of this usually is, if my memory serves me correctly, and it doesn't always, but you know, snails and earthworms. While it's great to see the birds eat all these things, that they can be very detrimental to them. But, you know, ivermectin usually works. Valbazin works. Those two are the best that I have seen at controlling this. I have a client out on Long Island, New York, that keeps about 60 chickens running around, loves them dearly, takes as good a care as one can of 60 chickens that have free access to a stream. You know, they end up with abnormalities that they may not have if there were a fence put up there, but nobody's willing to do that, and therefore, you know, they spend a lot of time and effort trying to mitigate certain health conditions. One of them happens to be gapeworm. Another one is canker recently, you know, things of that nature. So, you know, just briefly speaking, that's the situation, you know, with gapeworm. There's a male and female. When they mate, they form a Y. So if you see one, you'll know that you've got both the male and the female. Very hard to get rid of, though, because kind of like heartworm in dogs and cats, if you've never, if your dog has been or cat is an outside animal and you decide tomorrow to treat it for heartworms and you get the medication, let's say not through a vet or whatever, and you go and you give it to them, you could kill them just by giving it to them, because as these all release in the bloodstream, they jam up the heart and die of a heart attack. The same thing can happen here. There can be so many of them, and they end up cutting off the air or whatever the case may be. So gapeworms are a problem. Every bird that yawns doesn't have it. And they're very difficult. Sometimes you can swab the trachea and you can pull something out of there. You have some blood or whatever. Very, very difficult to diagnose that way, because they don't come out in the droppings like the rest of them, because they just don't. But the ivermectin and the valbazin work extremely well for these. If you were to do it today, you'd come back in 10 days and do it again. I guess that's about it as far as that's concerned. So, yeah.
Okay, good. No, thank you very much. It's great, great information. And if there were just a few that weren't asked, but we will do that the next time we have Peter on, and we'll also cover, and I apologize, the in fact, I had kind of chosen to have the questions. We hadn't done that in a while, and
sure.
People have questions all the time, so I wanted to definitely get that done. And we'll still not summer yet, so when we have you back on, we can do heat-related illness for all of the folks that were interested in that.
I had suggested that mainly to head it off before it get, because I do have available, and we'll say it again, I do have available those artist rendering of a
swamp cooler.
Swamp cooler deal that you could make from a fan and a cooler and a little water pump and some ice, and available free to anybody that wants it. You know, send me an email and it's yours, no big deal.
That sounds super. Very, very, very good. Well, hey, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. We thank you pretty much every Monday. Of course, next Monday is Memorial Day, so no show on that day. And then the 3rd, you are out and about, so no show then. But I'll, of course, let everybody know via Facebook and Twitter when you will be returning, and we'll wrap up some of these other questions and talk about dealing with heat in the summertime. So I hope you have a great week and really a great weekend next weekend celebrating the holiday.
Okay, you too. Thanks, Andy.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye. And that's going to wrap up another show, Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Remember, no show tomorrow, but we will return on Wednesday talking about essential oils. That'll be Wednesday. Thursday, we have Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, coming on. If you'll give me just a second, I might be able to find out what we're going to be talking about on Thursday with Richard. Let's see. It looks like, mending and tending fences and gates. So if you've got a homestead and you've got fences and gates, if you have chickens and animals and livestock and everything else, you probably have fences and gates. So mending and tending fences and gates. That's going to be this Thursday for us homesteaders out there, this coming Thursday. So we do hope you can tune in the rest of the week here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Again, no show tomorrow. We'll be here Wednesday and Thursday, and then no show Friday and Monday because of the holiday weekend. So thank you for tuning in. Remember, you can listen to all of our archives at blogtalkradio.com, zoom.com, podcast.com, and iTunes.com completely free. over 800 episodes that you can tune in based on the topic you want to hear about. So thank you very much for tuning in today, and we'll see you, on Wednesday talking about essential oils. Have a great day, everybody. Love you all.